welcome to the teaching ministry of North Coast Church in Vista, California. We invite you to please open your Bibles as we join Pastor Chris Brown for today's message.
I sat beside the bed and I kept an eye on the clock and on the little meter on the instrument itself. Both those were timed. We knew that we couldn't hit the morphine pump more than the system would allow, and yet we knew, boy, at every soonest opportunity, as soon as we could put another dose in, we'd click the button. At times we knew even though it wasn't supposed to work, we would click the button just hoping something would get in the system. And we spent those last days just sitting by the bed and just watching life slip away and knowing there was nothing we could do, so our job was to try to make it go as peacefully as possible. And I remember just being rocked at that time. I was a young man in college, and for me, it was all about relationships. For me, it was about the classes that I was in. For me, it was about just all the fun of being a college guy. And yet, besides my father, this was my greatest mentor. And I sat there beside the bed and watched what cancer did to his body and watched his young family gather and how those last days just played out. From moments where there were still conversation to the final days where any thoughts and any sentences that were spoken were, well, they were distant memories that were just coming out. Boy, I tell you, that time in my life just rocked me. That time in my life where everything for me was more fun and games and just my future really just kind of honed down onto, boy, life is short, it's frail, and how do we live it? And maybe more importantly, how do we go out at the end? And I know you would agree, there's moments and events in all of our lives that we've taken part in that we would go back and say those were times that shaped us. I remember the first time I was standing there beside the bed, my wife is just digging into my forearm, and I look down and I see the very crown of Selah's head and that amazing experience of childbirth and to come out and just to be like, whoa, and everyone cleans up and wipes out. And everyone told me that the moment you see your first child, the moment you hold it, you're not going to understand the flood of love and emotion and bond that you have. And for me, that never happened. For me, it was this, what in the world? And this voice keep telling me, you better grow up, buddy. You got a kid. I can talk about it openly now because it happened with all three kids. I didn't start feeling attached until month number 6 and 7. I would sit there in the early stages just rocking, looking at this strange little creature going, it's breakable, it's breakable. But realizing I guess that's how I deal with the birth of kids. But that little girl just has shaped and rocked me. To that morning that you all remember exactly where you were and when you first heard it. My sister was the one that called me, and she was frantic. She wanted answers. She was scared. She wanted to know what my take on it was. And within a few moments, she realized I had no clue what she was talking about. So she told me to turn on the CV, and just as I saw the second plane and hit the second tower. And man, I remember this rush coming in, that my huge world that I thought I was on became very small. The security I had as an American just started to crumble, and I realized even then, I think the world will change from this moment on. Trying to make sure family's okay, to rush into a college campus where I was dealing with several thousand students who were far from home all day long. And after the end of a grueling 16, 17-hour day, I remember coming back home. In the darkness, I stood out in my front yard just to let everything of the day just kind of, I was drained. And I remember looking up at the sky, and that's when it hit. Our home then was right in the flight path of Ontario Airport. There was constant traffic, constant holding patterns, all kinds of blinking lights. And I remember staring up at the sky, and that's when I realized nothing was flying. And the gravity of the situation hit me. This is going to be huge. This is huge. I remember sitting on a balcony as a college student. She had this long, curly brown movie star hair, these incredible almond eyes, this tan skin. This little silver bracelet on, and as she squirted water in my hair and ran her fingers through it, she began to cut. And I sat there in my little drape thing going, this is the most amazing $5 haircut I've ever gotten. And a simple prayer, God, if you let me marry her, I'll serve you. Well, that was a prayer God answered. She cut my hair for over a decade. Still there today, cutting my little kid's hair the same as she cut mine. It was that moment that just shaped me. Things changed. We all have those moments in our life. Today I've been excited to look at him. In this Beyond the Glory series, we've been taking some biblical characters, putting them in the chair, and this little interview, turning the lights on them and saying, okay, not just the great stories we hear in the Bible, but what about behind the scenes? If we pull back the curtain, if you will, what's really there? Their flaws, their sins, their own brokenness, their own humanity, their own ego, their own pride, their own lies. And today we come to him. I will say, out of the top 20 moments and events in all of history, out of the top 20, this man was in the majority. In the majority. So if you want to join me, I want to give you a brief history, a resume of his life. I want to take you through so you can see, wow, how was this guy shaped and rocked? We're going to start in the book of Mark in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John toward the back of the Bible. Flip through, you can find the guys' names. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, in the book of Mark. If you've ever wanted to just study the Bible and you're afraid of getting lost, bring your Bible. We will always tell you where we're going and how to find it. And the professional Bible readers on your row will always slow down long enough until you get there with them. Hint. So we're in Mark 1, verse 16. Man, I love the sound of pages turning. It's got to be about the Word, not about us. Mark 1:16, we start the story. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Four Gospels that will carry the story of Jesus. Four Gospels that will say, this is the guy's life, this is what he did, this is what he taught, this is who he was. Chapter 1, the very beginning. Jesus leaves home and goes out and starts a public life. He's baptized in the river. The heavens open up and says, this is my son, whom I love. He starts teaching. And he starts collecting disciples. That wasn't new to Jesus, by the way. Every teacher and every great rabbi back there, and everyone traveled as a philosopher, as a teacher, they all had a group with them called disciples, simply followers. It's time for Jesus to pick his. And here's the story, 1:16. As Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake because they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I'll make you fishers of men. And at once they left their nets and they followed him. And when he had gone just a little further, he saw James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John in a boat preparing their nets. And without delay, he called them. And they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired men, and they followed him. Pretty cool resume off the start, isn't it? When it comes time for Jesus to look at all of humanity at that time, the entire population in the known world, and say, where will I start? Who will I pick? Who's he get? Simon, Andrew, number three, James. Now that's pretty cool. You know, somewhere in his head, as life started going on, he kept that right here. When the followers started getting thousands, he knew, yeah, but I'm number three. I mean, how's that for a beginning? Jesus himself lined up and goes, okay, I'm picking my team. And you're number three out of everyone he could choose. And the faith of James to already have heard enough of Jesus and see something in the way this guy looked in his eyes and in his character to say, I will leave the family business. I will leave dad, all of our hired men, the boats, the nets, the entire shipping trade. I'm going. And from the very beginning, he starts the stories. Okay, we're going to fly. We're going to stay in the book of Mark, but we're going to start turning pages. Turn to 3:13, just to the right. Should just be at page or two, 3:13 to the right. Chapter 3, verse 13. Jesus has been done all kinds of miracles. He walked up to the guy with the huge infection and the sores all over his body that's so contagious he has to live outside the city. And Jesus walks up to the leper and he puts his finger in the oozing pus of the man's arm and says, be cleaned. And molecules rearrange themselves and he's healed. And people are like, oh, that was Leper Larry. Look at him now. There's a hole cut in the roof. A paralyzed man is lowered down. And Jesus says, pick up your mat and walk. And paralyzed Pete starts walking across the crowd. And people are like, oh! And stories of Larry and Pete start spreading like crazy. He walks into town and he takes a loogie and he spits it in the mud. He puts it on the blind guy's eyes and now he can see. And word is starting to spread. And people are coming by thousands. And we have 3:13. So then Jesus goes up to the mountainside. And he called to him those that he wanted. And he came to them. Hey, thanks for coming today. I know there's thousands. I don't know if you can hear me in the back, but I got to pick a few that I want. Here's going to be your job description. He appointed 12, designating them apostles, that they may be with him, that he may send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. I got to pick a small group. You're going to hang out with me, mano y mano, for 24 hours a day for the next 3.5 years. Everything I say and do and think is going to be made known to you. With that, then, you're going to have a ton to teach, and you're also going to have authority and power to do it in. You imagine the hands. Me. I already got some names. 16. These are the 12 he appointed. Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. How cool is that? Third guy out of all humanity picked to be a follower. Now that there's hundreds, if not thousands of followers, Jesus goes, we need to get 12 just to walk with me. Simon, by the way, mind if I call you Petey from now on? Cool. You with me? And James. Number two, baby. Watch what gets in on. Go to 535 to the right. I know, we're turning, we're going, we're flying. 535. He takes those 12 in a boat. Amazing miracles keep happening. He's feeding 5,000 people out of a G.I. Joe lunchbox. He crosses the lake, and there's a crowd waiting for him because the stories are spreading. Jairus, the synagogue ruler, comes. He goes, my 12-year-old girl is dying, and there's a hush on the crowd. Not only are our needs not as important as a 12-year-old's life or death, but he's a spiritual leader. And as the crowd starts going to Jairus' house, a bleeding woman comes up in the crowd and touches his cloak, and she's healed. But Jesus stops and carries on this lengthy conversation with her. And in the midst of that, we have 535. So while Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler. Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? But ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, well, don't be afraid. Just believe. He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing. And he went in and said to them, why all this commotion? The child is not dead, but simply asleep. And they all laughed at him. What kind of fruitcake are you? Do you don't think that we can tell the difference between someone who's living and dead? Do you think we're some kind of podunk quacks living out here in the boonies? We've got the best medicine and technology at that time. We know when someone's passed from life to death, but he was just setting them up. And as a father goes into the house, a mom for maybe the first time in days leaves the side of a bed where she has just held that little 12-year-old until the last breath was gone. And now she stands and buries her head into the chest of a husband who has been out searching for help, and help has come too late. And in the midst of that embrace, Jesus slides to the side, kneels beside the bed, and this God in the flesh of all power has this compassion simply to reach out and touch. And to the 12-year-old in Aramaic, he says, Talitha koume. Breath comes back to her body. It simply means, little girl, sit up. And her eyes begin to open. And the family is shocked. And he says, don't tell anyone about this. She was sleeping. Because you know how cruel junior high is going to be if they find out she was a 12-year-old dead girl and make some macaroni and cheese. She's starving. She hasn't eaten in days. It's there in the Bible. Besides the macaroni, eat, you said, feed her. And there, in that little adobe house, there are three standing there, wide-eyed, jaws open. Peter, James, and John. A moment that has to rock you forever. Okay, 6-7. It should be on the same page or just across the page. 6-7 simply says this. Then Jesus went around teaching from village to village. 7. Calling the 12 to him, he sent them out 2 by 2, and he gave them authority over evil spirits. Go to verse 12. So they went out. They preached that people should repent. They drove out many demons, and they anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. James did that. I know all of our story is based on Jesus because the disciples write this and say, look, it's about Jesus, not about us. But there's a verse in there that said, by the way, when he gave us power and authority, we went out and we did miracles and we did healings and we cast out demons and we taught also. We're not going to write about us because the story's not about us. But there's a little verse in there that said, but by the way, there's so many miracles we're not going to write about. And James says, I was in on that. I did that. Go to 9:2. To the right, a couple more chapters. Bar none. One of my favorite stories in the entire Bible, at least in the top 50. Mark 9, verse 2. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John with him and led them up a high mountain where they were all alone. That's where we start. The crowds following leaves him. He takes the 12 to the bottom of the mountain and he stops and says, I'm about to do something. You guys need to wait here. But I'll take Peter, James, John.
Oh, they got to see the dead girl?
Why the same three? There's 12. Jesus, if you like three, if we have a four-person and a rotation and three in there, we could all get a shot at what's just, no, just those three. Okay, we'll stay. I don't know why. Every time he takes the 12 and wants to go further or deeper or show them something different, he picks the same three. That to me is incredibly unfair. Jesus had favorites. I don't like that. The reason why I don't like that, because I wouldn't have been picked three. It's not like there's a pecking order or a list. It's not like, well, I'm in the top two of all humanity. I'm in the top three. That's it. It's like, you know, number 12's less than. There's really no order if you're 10, 11, 12. But I guarantee you, if you're 1, 2, or 3, it's up here, isn't it? It's, you might not say it out loud, but you know. See you guys. I'm going up the mountain. And he takes them up the mountain, and all it says is this. There he was transfigured before them. His clothes became dazzling white, whiter than anyone in the world could ever bleach them. And there appeared before them Elijah and Moses, who were talking with Jesus. Are you kidding me? Three Jewish boys who have grown up their whole life in a Jewish land under Jewish religion and tradition. To go up to the mountaintop and to see your leader transfigured, a physical change, to see him become white, whiter than bleach. Luke will say he became the brightness of lightning shone through him. And there, Mo and Eli, who've been dead for 900 and 1400 years. For every good Jewish boy, this was mind-blowing. You grew up and had two superheroes in the Jewish nation. You had two action figures. You had two sets of pajamas, two sheet covers, two pillowcases, two underoos. They were always Moses and Eli. That was it. These guys led your people out of bondage. These guys called down fire from heaven. These guys split Red Sea. These are it. And as men, they stand there and they see him appear and talk with Jesus. Who gets that moment? James. James, you're allowed in on this. 1432. I'll give you a hint. There's only 16 chapters in the book of Mark. 1432 is getting down to the end. In fact, the last several chapters are only going to cover the last week of Jesus' life. This is it. In fact, 1432 is going to take us to that night. There was an upper room, a Last Supper. You might have seen the painting. That night, one betrayed him and left and went to go get the Romans. That night, Jesus finishes dinner and says, if they come and get me in town, this place is going to blow up. Let's get out to the garden. And out there in the lonely place, that night, Jesus has a decision to make that is the crux of his entire existence. And he will beg and he will plead three times, I do not want to die on the cross. I do not want to die on the cross. And a third time, if there is any other way to get someone like Chris into our family, let's do it. Because I do not want to die on this cross. I never got that growing up. Jesus came and did great things and skipped down the road and jumped up on the cross because he knew he loved me. I never got the torment that was there. I never got that he couldn't even hold himself up. I never got that he pleaded with God, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it. If there is any other way in heaven. Any other way in God's power. I do not want to do this. And God said, to get Chris, it's got to be done. And he says, all right, let's go meet the guards. Wow. In that moment, who does he rely on? In that moment, we have 1432. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus told his disciples, sit here while I pray. And he took Peter, James, and John along with him. And he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. My soul is overwhelmed with the point of sorrow to the point of death, he said to them. Stay here and keep watch. As he got to the garden, there's not much conversation because I think the disciples understand. And what he did in the upper room, and now, this is an eerie moment. In the darkness of the shadow of the moonlight and the trees and the shrubs they walk, he stops and says, guys, stay. I got to do this one alone. And as he starts to step, he turns, he goes, Pete, James, John, can you walk with me? and they walk. And there in the depths, he looks at him and says, guys, I'm broken. Guys, you don't understand the stress. You don't understand the burden. You don't understand what I'm feeling. I need help. Can you just pray with me? Who does he pick? The Son of God in the flesh to share the fear of the pain that's awaiting that next day. Who's he pick? James. James in the moonlight is face to face with the Savior, understanding it's the first time he's asked for help. And who's he ask? James. Boy, I told you in the top moments of all history, his own eyes saw it, his own ears heard it, his own feet walked it. How must that shape an individual? And I think somewhere in his heart, he knows, I'm special. I mean, I know it's a God thing, but man, I'm allowed in on something big here. I'm special. You say, how do you know that? Turn back. Mark chapter 10, 35. Our last look at James in the book of Mark. Back to the left. Mark 10, 35. They've been arguing on the road already. Okay, who's the best? Who's the greatest? I love that people that physically even walk with Jesus struggle with their own ego. Doesn't that give you some hope? Just some of you. Well, good. Gives your pastor hope. Mark 10, 35. Then James and John, son of Zebedee, came to Jesus. Teacher, they said, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. What do you want me to do for you? Jesus said. And they replied, let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in glory. Hey, you don't know what you're asking, Jesus said. Can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism that I'm baptized with? Can you really think you can do what I'm about to do? We can, they answered. And Jesus said to them, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with. But to sit at my right and my left, man, that's not even for me to grant. See, back then, understand the seat of power. That throne, whatever rule or administration was in charge, the two most important seats to that authority, number one, right hand. Your right hand man, that's where we get it from. That was the most important seat to whoever was in power. The second most important seat, yep, the one right there on the left. James and John have been let in on all these. I don't know why he picked the same three people. I think it would have been fairer to rotate. Everyone gets a shot at something there. I don't know if it's because they were picked from the very beginning and they had less to go on, and yet they still stepped out in faith. I don't know if Jesus looked at them and realized, man, there is something unique about these three. I don't know if he just loved James and John and he didn't want to trust Peter by himself back at camp when he was gone. I have no idea, but they're there. On a roadside break where the crowds are gone and Jesus isn't teaching, maybe he's out skipping stones on a little creek and James and John are like, now's our shot. Hey, Jesus, can we talk to you for a second? Hey, just promise to do whatever we're asking. And Jesus is like, what are you guys up to? Man, when you get power, can we sit at the right and the left? Can we be one and two? Because we know Pete's in there and there's not a third chair. Has he asked you yet? We're trying to jump the gun on this one. Jesus goes, you have no idea what you're asking for, do you? Oh, yeah, we do. See, they're still thinking it's going to be a military might, overthrow Rome, set up a new kingdom. But here's what it tells me about James. He knows. He's at the top of the class. Did you get that? When I was a senior in high school, I never went to the principal and said, hey, can I be valedictorian? Because he would have been like, you're not even walking. And I'm like, all right, that's good. That's good. But I know that last semester, senior year, there were six people fighting like cats and dogs, looking at every extra credit, every little point, whatever, on the GPA. Why? Because they knew they had a shot. James is there. James knows, man, by the way you've picked me, by the way you've treated me, third out of all humanity, second out of all of your followers, not that number matters, but I have it right here. The way you picked three, and we saw what happened with the dead girl, we saw what happened in the mountain, the way you take us in. Can we get valedictorian and salutatorian? And the other disciples know, voted most likely to succeed, James is in on that one. That's his life. Now we come to the book called Acts. I like the way it's titled. It's simply the actions after Jesus. Jesus did take that cross to allow me to be a son. He did raise 3 days later. He did tell his disciples, now my life, my risen life will be in you. Go out and do. And Acts has got great stories. The disciples at first are fearful. Then they wait, and the Spirit of God really does dwell within us when we come to Christ. And they start doing amazing things. People start hearing the gospel in their own language. Thousands start coming to know, oh my gosh, the one we heard all the stories about, he really was our Messiah. And they start believing. Peter and John go to the temple. There's a guy who's been crippled since birth. And they walk up and say, in the name of Jesus, walk. And the guy stands up and walks. And they're like, oh! And they start telling the stories of now these guys who are most likely to succeed. The guys that Jesus poured over 3 years into their life, just raising the potential personified that's in James. One of the most amazing converts is a guy named Saul. He's out persecuting people. He goes on the road. There's a blinding light. And it's Jesus saying, why are you persecuting me? And Saul's like, I didn't think you existed. You want to knock it off? Yes. And the guy does a 180. And everybody's like, wow, I got to believe now. Because even the guy that was the hitman against Christianity is now the preacher boy. And now it comes time to hear James. Remember, top three picked. Top two out of the 12. Three picked to get on the inside. The one Jesus leaned on and said, let me show you my heart. Can you pray for me? The one Jesus trusted and instructed. Now we get to hear his story. His followers have got to be waiting. We're in with the top guy. Acts chapter 12. Acts 12. If you're in Mark, Luke, John, Acts. To the right, Luke, John, Acts 12. 1. It simply says this. Now it was about this time that King Herod arrested some who belonged to the church, intending to persecute them. He had James, the brother of John, put to death with the sword. And when he saw that this pleased the Jews, he proceeded to seize Peter also. This happened during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And he gets one verse. Oh, you can read on. You can read the entire book of Acts. You can read Corinthians. You can start reading all the letters to the churches. You can finish his book. He doesn't come back. There's no 3 days and the head comes back on. There's no life that comes back out of the grave. He gets one verse. Oh, by the way, when Christianity started to spread, they grabbed James because he was valedictorian. And Herod cut off his head. And that's it? Do you imagine how this hit the community? Do you imagine how this hit the church? Those that are following him. Hey, who's your pastor? Oh, we got Frank. Who's your pastor? We got a guy named Bob. Who's yours? James. James? James. You guys are led by James? We got a 30-year plan to take over the world. We're going to cover all the known world, Eastern Europe. We're going to go. I mean, this thing's going to spread. James is amazing. You know, he was taught by Christ for 3.5 years. He's the inside. Number three, number two, fake. We got James. What's his life consist of? Well, they broke into his house and they grabbed him in the night and they cut off his head. Imagine the church. Well, where's God there? What a senseless tragedy. All that he had to live for, all that was going for him. That's how God treats the valedictorian? Imagine when that word hit the disciples. When the runner comes from the prison out of breath. John. They killed James. Easy, slow down. James, what's James? Popular name. Your brother. What do you mean he killed him? They killed him. He's our leader. 3.5 years of training. The disciples finally get game time. It's finally time to start the season. Right off the bat, you lose your quarterback? What's this been about? One verse, and that's it. For James, it's beyond the glory. It isn't about a sin issue. For James, it's beyond the glory. It's just sometimes the good die young. It's a loss of hope. It's a loss of dreams. It's a loss of expectations. It's the unexpected turns. It's that incredible tragedy and the unfairness of life that comes crashing in. Have you been there? Oh, it happens with the heroes. It happened with the best of the best. That those that were supposed to love you and stay till death do us part lasted as long until their own desires thought they wanted something else. And now you carry the scar. To those that were supposed to care for you and raise you and nurture you are the ones that have hurt you the most or the abandonment that you feel. For some of you, it is a loss of life. This time of year, just remembering not the chairs that are full, but the empty chairs. And where is God in the midst of that senselessness? Where are those that have to put up with the verbal abuse? Where are those that have been hurt and neglected? What about those of you that walk through life and you almost wish it was death because at least it would be an end, but now you have to live with your own hell? And where is God in that? Please, someone tell me. Have you been there? Not even my life. I look across the globe today. I look at the senseless violence. I look at the injustices. I look at the starvation. And you tell me there's a loving God of justice? Can someone please show me that one? And when I come to this Bible, it says, look, let's not talk about just greatness. Let's pull back the curtains and let's show you behind the scenes. This is James. Well, why'd God do that? And someone puts their arm around you. Well, James was so good. I think God just wanted him home early. Oh, shut up. I'm so tired of hearing comments like that. God didn't want James to die. There was a ruler at that time, a wicked man named Herod, who realized, if I start knocking off these Christians, I can get more votes. So give me my sword. And one by one, they're going to start to go down. People, all 11 disciples will die except for John. Every one of them tortured and executed. Every one of them, even in death at the sword, will look up and say, I know what I saw. I know what I did. We didn't sit in a cave somewhere and just make this stuff up. 2,000 Christians will fall in those first two decades, and every one of them will say, I'll choose death. It's what brought me back to Christianity. They go, man, there is something in that start where the Roman government would have looked for any crack and anybody that stood and said, look, here's how it all came about. We made it up. And they would have promoted that like wildfire. And yet history says it's not there. So how do we cope with life when there's so much pain and suffering? Well, to do that, if you're in the book of Acts, the next set of books are called Corinthians. Whoops. The next book is called Romans. Turn to Romans chapter 8. I guess you know where we're going after Romans. Turn to Romans chapter 8, verse 17. Why didn't God help, especially someone like James? Could he have? Oh, yeah. Peter's arrested. Read the end of chapter 12 on your own. Peter's sitting in chair, and they double the guards. Herod can't wait to kill Peter. An angel comes. The guards are sleeping. An angel takes the chains off, opens the cell door, and lets him walk right out. He goes to a home where the Bible study is happening. He knocks on the door. They come and look at him. He goes, hey, you guys been praying for me? And they're like, oh, and they slam the door on him. They keep praying. God's like, your answer's there. What's the moral of the story? Well, if James just had more people praying for him, he'd probably be alive. Man, I'm tired of that theology, folks. Why does bad things happen to you? Well, if you had more faith, if you would have prayed more, God could have stepped in. But that's not biblical. That's not right. Can God step in and do miracles and heal and touch and remove tragedies? Yes, that is his power. That is his prerogative. But folks, they're called miracles for a reason because they're not everyday happenstance. They're rare. God saves Peter and James dies. Is that fair? I can't explain that. Couldn't God step in and stop the senseless loss of life that you've experienced? Yeah. Why? Because it was tragic. It was an accident. It shouldn't have happened. There was a lot of life left. Okay, well, what age does God step in and save life? Because whatever age we say is too young to die, I guarantee you there's someone plus one that says, well, what about our situation? So wouldn't God just need to stop death? And what about physical death? What about the emotional pain and heartache that some of you walk around with? Shouldn't God have stepped in and stopped you? Well, you know, yeah, I guess the physical pain and rape or molestation, he should have. What about the emotional abuse that some of you have had? Shouldn't God have stepped in? Well, I guess if he's stepping in, he should have. And you see how it goes on? And there is no free will. God said their free will is you can choose me. That same freedom means others can choose to do their own. And that means their circumstances are going to have huge consequences on others that are innocent. How do you deal with that unfairness? Here's what Paul says, Romans 8, 17, talking about how we can become children of God. He says, now, if we are children, then we are heirs, heirs of God and co-heirs with Christ. If indeed we share in his sufferings, in order that we may also share in his glory. He says, yes, it's true that when you come to Christ and accept him, you can be a child of God. And that gives you glory. That gives you amazing. That gives you heaven as your home. That means you are an heir to the kingdom. When I die, I inherit eternal life with God. Simply because when I die, he goes, Chris, you're my son. I've adopted you when you received me. He says, realize that makes us also co-heirs with Christ. The same relationship Jesus had with God, I can have with God. When Jesus said, Father, those are the words I get to use. Abba, Father. And he looks down and goes, Chris, I recognize you just like I recognize my son. You're adopted.
He sees me as he saw Jesus. Are you kidding me? He said, but understand, with that, we also share in suffering, just like Jesus came and suffered. This world is a cruel, jacked up place with a lot of unfair and injustices. Look at the life of Christ. How easy was that? He had persecution at every turn. He went town to town to town because they had a price on his head and he was always one step ahead. And the end of his life, how fair was that? And at the age of 33 to go? Yeah. So he says, here's how I deal with it. Verse 18, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. Even though I have to live on earth and there's heartache and brokenness, I understand this little minute existence, even if you eke it out to 90, 105, 108 years, this little existence in nowhere is going to compare to what I have one day. I know it's what I focus on here. He goes, that's where I take my mind and say, man, I'm glad this is short term here. That is my life. Here is where I got to walk on earth like Jesus walked. And man, they weren't fair to him. Why should I expect fairness to me? Well, why is that? He doesn't leave you hanging. Go on. Verse 19. See, the creation itself waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. For since creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage of decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. We know that the entire or the whole creation has been groaning, as in the pains of childbirth, right up to this present time. Paul says, you know why there's suffering and unfairness and injustice? We live in a broken world. We live in a world that all the way back to Genesis 3, where there was a perfect garden, had sin, and mankind chose to sin over what God wanted. And he goes, from that point on, creation itself, our cosmos is groaning. It's been in a state of decay ever since. Whether it's the air quality or your global warming warnings, or whether it's just the act itself of just what we're doing to our planet, he said, it's not getting better. That's the effect of sin, even on the cosmos. And the earth itself is groaning to say, God, one day when you come back and take man, you will also take creation and bring back, as Isaiah calls it, a new earth with all peace, even amongst the animal kingdom. Until then, he goes, man, this is jacked up. We are on a spiral of sinful people and a sinful world. I married a sinful woman. Together, two sinners have produced three little sinners that run around. And the effect of people in sin and life that have made choices that affect me, man, it's daily. And some of you are taking the consequences of other selfishness, of others' abandonment, of others seeking their own desire instead of right and wrong. And you're carrying the price. And Paul says, why does that surprise us? We live in a world that's got a freedom of choice. And when sin entered it, there it is. And yet we still blame God. And the whole time God's like, are you kidding me? This was never my desire, my plan. I told you from the beginning, Satan comes to steal, kill, and destroy, John 10:10. Why don't we blame him? When I have an ex-brother-in-law that molested my nieces, the anger and hatred I had at that guy for years, until I realized I saw him and just where he was in prison and what he was doing, I realized what a wasted man. And I felt so sorry for him. And I no longer hated him. I hated the sin that he chose that destroyed his life. And because he gave his life to it, it destroyed others that I love. And I seek a God that says, I hate that as much as you do, and even more, Chris. And Paul says, we are on a planet that's growing. But it's not groaning to death. It's like in childbearing, he says. It's groaning until one day this life that God has promised comes. It's groaning toward a hope. And he says this in verse 23. Not only the earth, or not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we are saved. But hope that is seen is no hope at all. He goes, in ourselves, I groan. I'm tired of being beaten. I'm tired of being left for dead, he says. I'm tired of being chased. I'm tired of being persecuted. Myself, I have hope. And it's not in what I see, folks. That's not hope. He says, I have hope in what I don't see, but what's been promised. So what's that look like for us? Okay, now, the next books are the Corinthians. Turn to the second one, 2 Corinthians 5. It's our last passage. When pastors say last passage, it's in hopes to get your attention back, but it means there might be 3 hours left.
2 Corinthians 5. There's not. Second Corinthians 5 simply says this. Now we know that if this earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we do groan. We long to be clothed in our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and we are burdened. Look at verse 6. Therefore, we will always have confidence and know that as long as we are at home in this body, we are going to be away from the Lord. We have to live by faith, not by what we see. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with God. So we make it our goal to please Him, whether we are home in the body or away from Him. Paul says, let me tell you what I focus on. This body that I have, he goes, it's simply it's a tent. It's a temporary dwelling. In my life, there's so much more to it than what I have here. So I don't fix all my values and hopes on what I have here. He said, I fix my hope on one day when I leave this tent is when life starts for eternity. And that is going to be so amazing. Until then, I have this little existence and there will be suffering and pain. And that is the effect of sin. And I will hate sin all the more. And as long as I'm here, I know then I have a purpose to be a light because people count. But guys, I got to tell you, there's times I want to leave this and just be home. There's times, he says, where I would choose death in a heartbeat because I know what comes. But that's not mine to take. So until He takes me, I will walk on. Don't you love that picture? He says, I compare my life to a tent. I got online. I went to REI because that's one of the more expensive camping places I know. And I looked. You have to search really hard to spend more than $500 for a tent. Tents are cheap. You can go to Costco and for $80 I can buy one that can sleep my neighborhood. It's amazing. An $80 tent. I can sleep out in like 20 of one of those things. I can take it out, live in it for my friends. When I'm done, if it gets ripped, I just put it all and throw it in the dumpster. And I'm like, well, there's $80. No big deal. It's a tent. Paul says, that's my life. Then why do we struggle? Because if you think like me, my sin nature says, no, this is heaven. I try to find my heaven here. I try to make this my kingdom. Life is really important. Look what I made. No, Chris, it's temporary. Oh, look what I get to do. It's all temporary. Look at my banking. It's all temporary. Look where I've come from and put myself through college. It's all temporary. But look at what I've been able to. Chris, it's all temporary. And when I get so focused on my tent and I think this should be heaven and things should be fair and things should be right, and I forget what is hoped and promised to me, no wonder I just have so much suffering and I can't get beyond it. And Paul says, you're worried about your tent? People, you don't put much value in your tent. You don't put much valuable things in your tent. A tent is a throwaway structure that hopefully keeps the rain off of you for $80. You can buy a cheap one for $35 from Big Five. I feel like one day God will open the gates of heaven, or God now says, do you get what I'm making for you in this gated kingdom? And we're like, don't bother me. I have my tent. He's like, your tent? Are you kidding me? Do you understand heaven? Do you understand eternity and what you get? God, look at my tent. A little, I get little steaks and pop can't I go on. Paul was able to go through his suffering and trials and say, I realize this is temporary. My God, I wish you would just kill me and take me on some days. Because I know that's where life starts. And until then, I'm sick and tired of the hurts and pains and suffering of life. But Jesus, I saw how you suffered. And if I need to momentarily take that journey in order to get glory, if you want me here to be some sort of light because other people still count, then that's got to be my purpose. But God, I'm tired of it. My body groans. The earth itself groans. We are so waiting for heaven to come. Do you really eagerly wait for heaven? Or do you hope, man, I hope that doesn't come for a long time because I got cool stuff in my tent. People, I love my tent. No wonder I have such a hard time with suffering in life. Have you been there? So to take it home, we've circled these things a couple times. I just want you to fill in the blanks so you have these. Number one, expect the world to be broken. It's all about what you expect. If you're trying to get heaven now and you're a believer, man, you are so far off pace. If you want God's love and justice, grace, everything now to be utopia, man, you're going to be disappointed. Now, if you don't yet know Christ, you better do whatever your body and desires want you to do here on earth, because it might be the only taste of heaven you get. Because a life lived without Christ, you're choosing eternity also without Christ if you're not a son and daughter. There's a warning there, folks. But if we expect the world to be broken, if I get a gift and open it and it's in pieces, I'm like, oh, man, I shook it too hard the last 3 weeks. I shouldn't have done that. But if someone tells me, Chris, we bought you something, but we got a discount because it's broken, I'm going to open up and look for the break and go, hey, we can fix that. That's okay. We can do that. It's all about my expectation. I put money into a valuable piece of art and I bring it home and it's all shredded. I'm like, oh, no. But if I buy a puzzle, well, I expect a jumble. Paul writes and says, why do we expect heaven now? It comes later. It is a promise that we have hope and we persevere for. But now, man, expect pieces. So when they come, you will be hurt. When they come, you will feel the suffering. But when you come, you will still hold on to, dang, this tent. I'm so ready to chuck this because I have this. And I'm not blown away because this is my existence. I know it's up here. Expect life to be broken. I had to sit in a church a couple weeks ago and watch my older brother, one of my heroes of life, stand before his congregation and resign. He said, people resign because of ethical reasons. We know this isn't one. People resign because of sin and moral failure. We know this isn't one. He said to his church, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to resign, he said, as a pastor who loves his people and as a church who loves him. But over 2 years ago, he went to the Amazon with a group of people and he shattered his back to a point where they haven't been able to fix it. He's been living in a bed in his living room for the last 2 years. When he's up for longer than 15 or 20 minutes, it takes him days to recuperate from that. And his church for 2 years said, we don't care if you teach. We don't care if you come. You're our pastor. You're our pastor. And I watched the agony and pain on his face just to hold on to a pulpit and say, guys, don't blame God. If I live in a broken world, then that means there will be a broken back. And I still pray that God can step in and heal. And if he doesn't, so that's what I do for the next 10, 20, 30 years until I get glory. And I thought, man, I love that that guy's my brother. What a story. Does he like where he's at right now? Oh, no. People, if you go through suffering, you pray, God, I want it out of my life. And then you also pray, oh, God, give me what I need to get through this. And here's the next thing you do. We really don't know our future. Understand that. We really don't know our future. You can cross out the word "are" there and put "his" over it because it's not our future anyway. James says that. You say you're going next year or the next year and doing this kind of business. He goes, you know you're bragging before God? 2-year plans? You're not in control of your life. Instead, you ought to say, God, I think this is what you're asking me to do. I'm going to do it. Anything else, because just boasting and bragging, you're a mist, you're a vapor. You're here today, gone tomorrow. Just understand, we really don't know his future. Someone once said, well, live today. You should leave home. I was at a conference. You should leave home every day as if it was your last day to see your family. How do you treat your wife and kids before you leave home? And I thought, man, that's good. And then I was driving home from the conference going, that was the stupidest piece of advice I ever got. If it was my last day, I wouldn't be leaving home and going to work. If it was my last day, I wouldn't have paid $300 for your conference either. You don't abandon all and just go, it's my last day, I got to do everything. But there's got to be that thing of, God, may I, number three, may I be obedient as today, not tomorrow. May you show me today what I can do. I don't care what your suffering is. I don't know what you're waiting for. I don't know who in your life that you're saying, well, next time. But obedience is today. None of us are guaranteed a tomorrow. God has a purpose in today. And lastly, death is graduation. Do we get that? When a 103-year-old dies after a long, successful life, we call it a great homecoming. She had her home going today. When a 33-year-old dies, we call it tragic. Now, people I know, when we lose life in a loved one, it is a hurt and a pain that may stick with us forever. But do we really understand, though, if they're a believer, the moment they die is graduation. And I don't care what they left behind and what potential they had, they would not give anything to come back and restart their life again. They have tasted glory. And for them to look down at their tent and go, oh, I'd really like to come back. Oh, come on. Come on. People, we will have hurt, we will pain. The Bible doesn't say don't feel bad. The Bible doesn't say don't suffer. The Bible says in the midst of your suffering, here's your hope. And in the midst of this season, where so many of us are face to face with our suffering and brokenness. I just felt like this is the stuff we need to focus on today. Because this is promise, hope, my future, your life. God, may you take us through it. May you give us what we need to get through it. May we choose every day to be obedient where we are. And yet, God, if possible, may we still pray that you take the suffering out. Thanks for hope and your glory. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed today's study from God's Word. Pastor Chris will return in a moment with some final comments. For more information, or if you'd like additional copies, please contact us at area code 760-724-6700. Our mailing address is North Coast Church, 1132 North Melrose Drive, Vista, California, 92083. Or visit our website at www.northcoastchurch.com. Now here's Pastor Chris.
I don't know why it surprises us. When Jesus himself said, don't be surprised if the world hates you, it hates me, and you're following me. Where he said, here's Christianity, pick up your cross and follow me. Where he says, if you really want to save your life, learn how to lose it. And yet I think the problem is we still try to get heaven here. And God says, no, heaven comes later. Here there's the effect of sin. And he says, the thief has come to steal, kill, and destroy. Satan will do anything he can to rob you of your joy, a happiness, a life, and of your light, especially if you're a follower of Christ. It's the only way he gets back at God. And when someone chooses his way and affects us, we blame God. That's ironic. Hopefully maybe something today, something you can do with and take out through a season that might be a hard one for you to travel. Some hope, some perseverance, some faith. So glad you're here today. Turn around, greet another camper, and we'll see you guys next week.